It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The conflict between Israel and Hamas can be difficult to talk about, and it's especially sensitive for people with a connection to the region. Many people of Jewish and Muslim faith in the United States are feeling the pain of that war on the other side of the planet, and it could shape how they view the conflict and the parties involved. It can make it harder for us to have conversations about contentious issues like this one, especially with people who have different beliefs than our own. A new center on the UW-Madison campus is working to bridge those religious divides and promote better cooperation and understanding. We're learning more about how to have better, more productive dialogue with people of different religious backgrounds. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How often do you interact with people of different faiths than your own? Have you talked to friends or acquaintances about this Israel-Hamas war? How have those conversations gone? Do you have questions about how to have those kind of difficult conversations? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ulrich Rosenhagen is the interim director of the Center for Interfaith Dialogue at UW-Madison and an ordained Lutheran pastor. Ulrich, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, glad to be here.
First of all, can you tell us about this still relatively new Center for Interfaith Dialogue? What kind of things are part of your mission?
Well, it is new and it is not that new. So I'm doing interreligious work on campus for 16 years with different centers. But it's new now because it moved from the College of Letters and Science to Student Affairs. And the emphasis is now different of the interfaith work with the new center. The first center was the Luber Institute for the Study of the Abrahamic Religions. The second one was the Center for Religion and Global Citizenry, and now it's the Center for Interfaith Dialogue.
What kind of things do you do to try to convene interfaith dialogue, to bring people together and have hopefully civil conversations, even with people of different faith and other backgrounds?
Yeah, the core of the center is a student community. It's a group of students whom we call interfaith fellows, and they work closely with me for the full academic year. And the program I developed over the years has different stages. So it's actually very much the same every year, kind of the way it's designed. The first phase is that students come, get to know each other, build relationships, develop trust. We give ourselves a set of rules. In the second phase, students learn from each other. So it's what I call the religious literacy phase. We talk about core values, core convictions, stories, sacred stories from our traditions. We explain practices, holidays. We come together over potluck, etc. The third phase then is that we experience as an interfaith community, we experience different things. We go to different places of worship. We go on a silent retreat, an overnight retreat where we explore contemplative traditions. And then the students, the interfaith fellows also organize program on campus and then actually execute that. So that's part of the learning process, that they're able then to facilitate dialogue and organize dialogue on campus.
After going through a process like that, do you find that people of different faith backgrounds come away feeling more positively about each other or better able to communicate with people who are from different traditions than their own?
Well, I hear from students who have gone through the program and are out now, 5, 10, 12 years, that the program always has helped them when they graduate and then start a professional life. They always help them to work in groups, in the workplace, in a corporate setting, because, you know, wherever we are living in diverse communities. And a piece of that program is that you learn how to negotiate difference. You learn, or you realize you don't have to be the same. You can come from very different ends of the spectrum, and then you discover what do you have in common, what you share, and also where you disagree. And you do this in a very respectful way, so there are different things my fellows learn, different things they reflect upon, and the feedback I receive from my, if you will, my alumni is very, very good. So they always say that they benefited enormously from the program.
Talking to Ulrich Rosenhagen with the Center for Interfaith Dialogue at UW-Madison, talking about having conversations, including about difficult issues among people of different faith backgrounds. Ulrich, the center's Faith Advisory Council released a statement last week about First Amendment speech on Israel and Palestine, urging the public to, quote, speak freely but with humility, end quote, and to act strongly but do not harm. Can you talk a little bit about what you hope people take away from the message, that message, as we have this very divisive, in many cases, debate here in the United States?
Well, obviously, at a public university, First Amendment rights are very important. But I think we tend to forget that what is legally allowed or what is our right based on the Constitution needs to be kind of embedded in a moral, in a set of values, in some form of moral imagination. And that's basically what we try to express in this statement, that we don't have to always insist on this right, or when we speak, when we make use of the right to express ourselves, the right to free speech, we may harm other people. So we have to be respectful in the community we live. We have to recognize the other, take into regard how our words can harm on other people. And that is something I think that council we have at the center expressed in a beautiful way, I think, emphasizing that we respect each other and we have to be mindful of the way we conduct ourselves when we use our freedom of speech.
And that statement actually cites religious documents from Islam, Judaism, and Christianity that point toward that ability to have that kind of civil conversation. Can you talk about how we can find that call in different religious traditions?
Well, I think that all great religious traditions share things like the dignity of the individual, the sanctity of human life, ideas of justice, of compassion. That is, I mean, across the board, you go from one tradition to the next, and our sacred texts, our sacred rituals express this, remind us of this, and also give us a story where we can place ourselves in. And because it's an interfaith council, because we have several different traditions, we wanted to express this. We wanted to show, we wanted to say, we draw in our respect for the other, in our humility when we speak and use our right to express ourselves. And this humility, we draw on our sacred texts, on our religious traditions. And we find this, you pointed at the three examples we mentioned in the statement. We wanted to say this is not just one tradition. And we share this. And though we are different, though we disagree on issues, though we worship differently, we have deeply held beliefs we all have in common.
A lot of the interactions we see, especially in the news, are a protest and counter-protest, or people from with different perspectives, say on Israel and Hamas and the Palestinians on different sides. Obviously, it can be very heated. People may have genuine and well-founded grievances coming from any of those perspectives. In that kind of situation, without that, I think, safety of an interfaith group like yours, how can we, I don't know, turn down the heat a little bit to recognize each other's, to hear each other's arguments?
Well, first of all, I think you have to have a community where you do this, where you have to have an interfaith community. So you need to have friends, classmates who come from a different tradition. And then you hope that the bonds you have built over time, the relationships you have built, are strong enough that even in a moment of crisis, they don't break apart. Then I guess you also share the grief in those groups. I mean, in my current student group, so I have Sikhs, Hindu, variety of Christian, Jewish, and Muslim. And their stories following the conflict are very personal and very traumatizing. So you want to have relationships where you can still sit and listen, and be careful, be mindful of the trauma, the shock the other experienced. It's the creation of small groups that are together and willing to listen to each other and in situations of crisis, which I think is something very helpful.
We're talking to Ulrich Rosenhagen from the UW-Madison Center for Interfaith Dialogue about how to have healthy, productive conversations with people of different faiths than our own, even when it comes to controversial and divisive topics like Israel and Palestine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done some kind of interfaith work, maybe in your own community? Do you have friends or family members of different religious backgrounds? How do you talk to each other about those different faith traditions? And what kind of conversations have you had with people in your life about the conflict in Gaza? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Ulrich Rosenhagen, Interim Director of the Center for Interfaith Dialogue at UW-Madison, talking today about how to talk about topics, including controversial topics like the conflict between Israel and Hamas. When we're talking to people of different faith backgrounds, he says we need to create communities of people getting to know each other, getting to understand each other. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you, in a formal way or maybe in an informal way, had these kind of dialogues in your life with people of different faith groups? Do you work in community groups that bring together people from different backgrounds like that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Minocqua. Mike, hello.
Hi, Rob. Just wondering, you know, worldviews do come into opposing positions. And so if it's something really important, say the Judeo-Christian perspective based on biblical teaching that the Jewish people have a right to the land that they're in now, as opposed to maybe Arabic and Islamic traditions and faith teaching that would be opposed to that. So if we have two views that are in direct opposition to one another, either one's right and the other's wrong, or they're both wrong, and how do we have a conversation when we're in a situation like that?
Mike, interesting question. Ulrich, what do you think?
Well, I usually try to avoid these absolute truth questions. This one is right and one is wrong. I tend to think that once you look closer, things are always more complex than they seem at first sight. For Israel, I mean, it's a phrase people use is it's two people, three religions, and they all somehow belong there and have relations and histories that are deeply entwined and with the land historically. There are different, the narratives are entwined. So I don't like these either or questions, and I don't believe that we can have reality that's sanitized, if you will, that's separated by this is right and this is wrong. In fact, I used to quote a text to my students that I like a lot by Rabbi Hirschfeld, Brett Hirschfeld, who used to be part of the settler movement, and then returned to the US. And the book is titled, You Don't Have to Be Right for Me to Be Wrong. So the idea is that two things can be true at the same time, and the title expresses that. I think we need to learn that different things can be right, maybe true at the same time.
Mike, thanks for the call. I always think back, Ulrich, to, you know, Europe in the 15 and 1600s, where if you asked people, you know, is it possible for Protestants and Catholics to live in the same country peacefully? I think the answer would for those of them be no. Obviously, things have managed to change since then. So sometimes, hopefully, seemingly intractable oppositions, as Mike is suggesting there, can get resolved over time.
Well, that's the hope. That's the vision. And I actually think that interfaith dialogue can help us with this. I think that religion, at least the way I make sense of the different religious traditions, they can coexist. They can be both true. What's true for me is not necessarily true for someone else. And we have to learn this. I think that's the big challenge in the 21st century, living in a diverse America, living in religious pluralism. That means we have to learn that we coexist. And the beautiful piece is when we discover what we have in common, the mutuality religious traditions share. And that's, I think that's the process we are in, if you will, historically speaking.
Talking to Ulrich Rosenhagen with the Center for Interfaith Dialogue at UW-Madison, talking about how to promote dialogue between people of different faith backgrounds. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to another caller now. Anne is with us in Milwaukee. Anne, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just would like to make a point, or maybe ask your guests if you could comment on the fact that Judaism is not Zionism. And it seems to me that both Zionism and Israel have cloaked themselves in a mantle of Judaism to deflect criticism of the Zionist ideology of occupation in the political state of Israel.
And thanks for the call, Ulrich. I don't know if you want to weigh in on the distinction Anne is making, but is it easy when we try to have interfaith dialogue to get caught up in how we define ourselves, how we define others along the lines that Anne's talking about?
Yeah, and I'm certainly not an expert on what is Zionism. And I mean, it started out as a utopian movement in 19th century Europe. Today, my students, some students have a very different idea of what it means. I think interfaith dialogue helps us to create a space where we can kind of define or figure out what are our definitions. How do we make sense of certain terms that are buzzing around? And so it's helpful to listen to each other and hear when we use a word like Zionism, what do you mean by this? And that might not be the same I mean when using that term. So what I'm doing on campus certainly creates a space that we can wrestle with these definitions and hopefully come out with a better and bigger understanding of each other.
And thanks a lot for the call. Ulrich, this kind of interfaith work you're doing sounds like a good setting for people to get to know each other and a safe space, if you will, to have these kind of conversations in a productive way. A lot of times, again, I keep coming back to when two people meet each other at a protest from different sides or run into each other online, often they're complete strangers. There is no community between them in some ways. What would you ask people to keep in their minds in that situation where they may be escalating a conversation, a dispute with someone that they don't even know?
Well, I'm in a slightly better position because my center is a UW-Madison center. So I have a community. Mm-hmm. I have a campus community. And students know that although they're different and they They come from different religious traditions. They traffic in different student communities. In the end, we are all in this together as a campus community. I think the statement appealed in its essence, appealed to people, even if you express your free speech, and make sure not to do harm. So that's, we have to be careful that our conversations don't turn into heated arguments and then escalate even further. I think it with my fellows, I hope, or my idea, my hope is that my interfaith fellows can be on campus at least, something like ambassadors at large, who can facilitate conversation and can get between people before the situation escalates. And so we have to contain ourselves. I think we also have to remember that there is an, if you will, so moral values, a moral imagination, if you will, that needs to go along with us using the First Amendment. We have to be mindful the way words and actions resonate on with someone of a different opinion from a different group. And we kind of anticipate this and don't let things escalate. I think interfaith dialogue can teach you this, because it's you're in this in a diverse group of students, a diverse group of people. And that's what we are on campus, and that's what we are in America. We are in this as a diverse community, and be mindful of that, and that I think will help.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Happy to be here.
That's Ulrich Rosenhagen, Interim Director of the Center for Interfaith Dialogue at UW-Madison, with us to share how we could have better conversations about sometimes controversial topics with people who have different faiths than our own. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, pharmacists at a couple major chains recently walked off the job for a few days to protest an increased workload. We'll find out more about conditions in the industry and what it means for pharmacy customers. First, around 700 people live year-round on isolated Washington Island. For years, residents' access to the internet was slow and often unreliable. Now, Washington Island is the site of a new broadband expansion project. As Evan Casey reports, it's part of a statewide push to connect all Wisconsinites.
Courtney and Eric DeJardin live on Washington Island, which sits off the northern tip of Door County. They own the busy Mann's Mercantile General Store. Its walls are lined with souvenirs as customers fill the aisles. But living on an island doesn't come without its challenges. One of them, slow and spotty internet service.
When you got a business like this where you have, you know, mass customers walking in your door at from open till close, and if you don't have any internet service, you don't have any money coming in.
That's the sound of construction workers unspooling several hundred feet of fiber optic cable. They're at work deep in the woods, about 5 miles from Mann's Mercantile. It's a cool September day, and workers wearing hard hats are high up on a utility pole with the cable. When it's installed, they'll go from having slow and unreliable internet to lightning-fast service. The work is part of a new $7 million fiber optic network that's running across the island. The goal is to bring the faster service to any home and business that wants it. Robert Cornell is a manager of the Washington Island Electric Co-op and the driving force behind the project. He likes to drive across the 35 square mile island and count the homes with the service.
It's kind of fun because this is where we started, and I can go down the road and I can say, he has it, they have it, they have it, they have it. We've got them connected, and everybody on this road is connected.
Nearly 250 locations on the island now have the service. That includes Mann's Mercantile. The project is partly funded by the co-op, but around half of it is being paid for through grants, including $2.5 million from the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. The state has been working to expand broadband access, especially in rural areas, for over a decade. but almost a quarter of a million homes and businesses still don't have access to internet that can support basic video streaming. Federal grants support broadband expansion through the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program. It goes by the acronym BEAD. Wisconsin got $1 billion from that program. Public Service Commission Chair Rebecca Vock says it'll take more than just the federal money to reach all Wisconsinites with connections fast enough to support video calls and gaming.
We know it's going to take more than the BEAD allocation to get everybody to 100 by 2030. But we're confident that we're going to make incredible progress by 2030.
Earlier this year, state lawmakers rejected a proposal from Governor Tony Evers to expand broadband access. Vock believes that'll slow the process down. On Washington Island, Michael Gillespie doesn't have the new service at his home yet, but he does have it at his office. He says it helps with downloading and sending large PDF documents needed for his job as a plumber.
We're usually kind of the last for new technologies. They say plumbing came here 20 years after it came to the mainland in the, you know, early part of the century, but we're leaders in this, so that's pretty exciting that little Washington Island can have fiber optic internet.
It could be several more years until everyone has access across the state. And as time goes on, old infrastructure may not be suitable to bring high speeds to everyone as technology continues to grow and evolve. But for Gillespie and his wife Danny, the new infrastructure can't come to their home fast enough. Robert Cornell often jokes with Danny about the pace of the project.
Cannot wait till the high speed to go to my house.
It's coming.
I keep asking, when is it my house?
We move it out a week every time you ask.
The project is expected to be completed by the end of 2025. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, pharmacy workers at Walgreens and CVS Pharmacy staged a three-day walkout at some locations last week in protest of what they describe as inadequate staffing and poor working conditions. The exact scale and impact of the walkouts is unclear, as statements released by Walgreens and CVS conflict with the accounts of some workers and protest organizers. Our next guest is an expert on the pharmacy workforce. He's done research about pharmacist workload, burnout, and job turnover. He joins us now for a look at the profession and how it all affects pharmacy customers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a customer, have you noticed maybe longer wait times, fewer hours at the local pharmacy? Is there a local pharmacy where you are? And if you work as a pharmacist or a pharmacy technician, what has changed in that profession over the last few years? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. David Mott is a professor of social and administrative sciences at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's good to join you. Thanks for having me.
Can you talk about some of the concerns that pharmacy workers were raising in these three-day walkouts at some of these chain stores?
Yeah, I think, a lot of these pharmacists, their walkouts really are a desperate attempt to draw attention to the poor working conditions and the resulting burnout that a lot of them say have been ignored for far too long. And we conducted a National Pharmacist Workforce Study in 2022, and really we were trying to figure out what were the impacts of COVID and where are pharmacists right now in terms of their work situations. And it was pretty shocking that about 60% of chain pharmacists in that study, they reported high levels of work exhaustion, and nearly 80% of them reported low levels of job satisfaction. So you've got a group of pharmacists out there that are working in these work environments, and it was getting bad before COVID, and now after COVID, it's gotten to a boiling point, I think, and they've kind of decided that they need to walk out and draw some attention to their situation.
Yeah, in that study, you looked at a pharmacist who'd worked at different locations, because pharmacists might work at hospitals or health clinics, small independent pharmacies, or these big chains. If I read your results right, Dave, these large chain pharmacists were feeling burnout, heavy workload, and more than in those other settings. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Certainly across all the settings, as you said, there are pharmacists that are burned out or have low job satisfaction. But as you said, and what we found in the main setting, that's where we see the worst situations, where the most pharmacists are burned out, the highest job satisfaction, and really the highest intention to leave their positions across all those settings.
So what's going on at those big chain pharmacies that's driving this?
Yeah, as I said, kind of what's been happening is this has been brewing for a while, you know, probably, 2014, 2015 sort of ramped up. And another study we did in 2019 showed that things have been growing in terms of burnout and poor satisfaction. And COVID was really, a difficult situation for all of healthcare providers. And I think one of the things that happened in pharmacy is pharmacists became really important access points for COVID vaccinations and other flu vaccinations. And unfortunately, in those chain environments, providing those COVID vaccinations just added on to the work that pharmacists were already doing in those environments in terms of dispensing prescriptions. And staffing levels, both pharmacist staffing levels and technician staffing levels, were decreasing. And you've got this perfect storm of decreased staff, both pharmacists and pharmacy technicians, combined with increased demand for vaccinations and prescription drugs. And it has just led to really poor work environments for these pharmacists. They are stressed out. They have way too much to do. They don't have enough staffing and a lot of demands from consumers to receive vaccinations or to receive dispensed prescription drugs. So it's a pretty difficult situation for those pharmacists.
I want to talk about that understaffing situation in two parts. First of all, pharmacists themselves, is there a pharmacist shortage where there just aren't enough to go around? And if I'm running a chain store, I'm struggling to bring them on?
Yeah, so the shortage situation is interesting. So before we did our study in 2022, actually, the HRSA, federal group that kind of looks at the status of health professionals, sort of predicted that there was going to be a surplus of pharmacists moving forward in the next 10 years or so. But recently, those projections have changed, where there's going to be a shortage now of pharmacists moving forward. So what's really going to be difficult, I think, for the change is a couple things. One is, if there is going to be the shortage moving forward, it's going to be hard for everybody, every employer, to attract pharmacists. But I think what's going to be really hard for the chains is, with all these newspaper articles and these walkouts, there's certainly a lot of information that chain environments may not be the best place for pharmacists to be working. So I just wonder, you know, whether pharmacists are going to say, you know, I am not going to go to one of these work environments where there's a shortage of pharmacists, there's a shortage of technicians, there's long lines of patients, there's a lot of demand for my services. I don't have time to practice pharmacy the way that I want to practice pharmacy. So the shortage combined with sort of this information that these environments may not be so great, that may not be a good situation for these chains in terms of hiring more pharmacists.
All right, and then part two, that was the pharmacists, pharmacy technicians, a shortage there, or at least not enough people, pharmacists are saying, on their staffs. What is happening there?
Yeah, so this is something that came up during the pandemic. A lot of technicians, pharmacies were very stressful work environments, a lot of health risks because of COVID, and I think a lot of technicians were being underpaid. A lot of them just decided to leave chain environments and being pharmacy technicians, and they pursued jobs in other sectors. And I think it's been really hard for chains and other pharmacies that employ technicians to bring technicians back. They need to improve work conditions for technicians. They need to increase pay for technicians. And they're beginning to see some information that chains are beginning to raise their wage rates to try to draw technicians back into those work environments.
Talking to Dave Mott, professor of social and administrative sciences at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison, about the causes and impacts of recent walkouts by some chain store pharmacy workers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed changes in your experience at the pharmacy in the years, especially since the pandemic? Do you notice longer lines or wait times or shorter hours if you work in this field or have left work in this field? Love to hear your perspective on that, whether you were working at a chain pharmacy, independent hospital, health clinic, you name it. What is your perspective on what's going on in pharmacies? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dave Mott, professor of social and administrative sciences at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison. talking about why pharmacy workers at CVS and Walgreens walked off the job at some locations and how understaffing and increasing workloads impact customer experience and even maybe customer safety. You could join in at 800-642-1234. As a customer, do you feel like you have a lot of face time with your pharmacist when you need it? Have you ever had a mistake happen with your prescription? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you if you work in the business as well. Dave, are we seeing solutions? Sticking with the chain stores for a moment, are we seeing efforts to fix these things? Anything successful that you can point to?
Yeah, so there have been some reports that the large chains are making investments or trying to make investments into the workforce. There's some reports of a few months ago of organizations raising wage rates, trying to offer signing bonuses to compensate pharmacists better. I think the concern about the signing bonuses, though, to have pharmacists work there is, again, you just kind of have to wonder if you're a pharmacist, a $70,000 signing bonus, you know, what does that mean? You know, why is this firm offering me $70,000 signing bonus to come there? It kind of raises questions about perhaps maybe that work environment isn't as positive as some other places that, you know, frankly, may not be offering a signing bonus. So we're seeing some reports that the chains are trying to increase pharmacist wages. I also mentioned there's some reports that technician wages are being increased. I know some of the chains are trying to leverage technology and free up pharmacist time at sites where prescriptions are dispensed. And what they're trying to do is use technology to fill prescriptions at central locations, especially refill prescriptions, and then have them brought to the local outlets to be dispensed to patients. The idea being there is that the pharmacists that are at those local sites don't have to spend so much time in the actual dispensing of these refill prescriptions. They can be done somewhere else and brought in, therefore freeing up the pharmacist's time to provide vaccinations or to check prescriptions that come in and talk with patients when they're having prescriptions dispensed. So there's some reports that this stuff is happening, but you know, you just don't know how long it's going to take for the situation to improve.
We heard from Dan in Muskego who couldn't stay on the line. He said he'd been experiencing poor service at a local chain pharmacy in his area. Finally left it, went to a big box store that's providing pharmacy services. Dave, are we at a point where you think customers are really feeling the impact of pharmacist overwork and burnout?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there was a recent Wall Street Journal report that showed that customer satisfaction with the large chains has dropped a lot recently, and it's probably because of the situation in these environments. You hear things about long lines, people not being really happy with each other, and the delays. So there's probably some screaming and yelling going on in those environments. We've heard things that pharmacists are being told to spend more time on providing vaccinations. What happens then if they're short-staffed? There's going to be a huge delay in filling prescriptions and dispensing them. So I've heard of patients going into pharmacies and not having prescriptions ready when they were told they were going to be ready. So these are all things that are going to make customers, patients very unhappy. They're probably things that have been brewing again. Like I said, the storm has been brewing. And you know, like the caller said, at some point, I would imagine consumers are going to say, I'm not going to this pharmacy anymore. I'm going to try to get my prescription drugs or other services at another pharmacy. So I think that's going to happen more, I think.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts, Dan, at 800-642-1234. Talking about the pharmacy business, a lot of overwork in all fields, all venues of the pharmacy profession, especially chain stores. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dave, are we worried about potential safety concerns if we have pharmacists filling more, you know, prescriptions per hour, per day, things like that? Do we worry about the potential for mistakes?
Yeah, this is a great question. This is one of the things we asked about in our study in 2022, where we asked pharmacists to describe their work environments for us. And we found out that a lot of pharmacists felt that they were being asked to do way too many activities without enough staffing. that their job extends beyond the typical work day, that they don't have autonomy in providing care and services the way that they want to. And then, of course, I mentioned the understaffing, and that a lot of chains focus on workload metrics. It's a very assembly line efficiency-driven business. They want pharmacists and technicians to produce prescriptions and services as fast as possible. And those were some of the characteristics in the work environment. And the thing that was really distressing is then pharmacists shared with us how those work characteristics then impact their perceptions of patient safety. And a lot of times we found over 80% of pharmacists that were experiencing these negative work characteristics, that they said that these characteristics significantly reduced patient medication safety in those work environments. So that's certainly a huge concern. You know, we're not saying that that is leading to errors every time, but certainly when pharmacists are saying that there's this perception that patient medication safety is being impacted, that's telling you that they do not feel comfortable, that they're not spending enough time making sure that what they're doing is as accurate and as safe as possible. And when you're in a situation like that, pharmacists have to work harder. They're stressed out more because they do not want to make a mistake. But when you're in an environment where you got a lot of stuff going on and you're not able to spend the time that you need to make sure things are accurate and safe, that's going to lead to a lot of stress, a lot of burnout, a lot of overwork and stressing to make sure that those medications are safe. And that, you know, pharmacists are kind of the safety net, right? They're the last point before a drug is dispensed to a patient. So that's a really, really critical step in our healthcare system to make sure pharmacists are checking everything to make sure everything is 100% accurate.
Oh, and related to that, Dave, you know, if I go into a pharmacy and get a prescription refill, I'm happy to just pay and go. If I get a new prescription for the first time, I often have questions for the pharmacist. Does the pharmacist in a lot of these situations have time for Rob's questions?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it all boils down to is me personally, when I have a new prescription, like you said, I want to go in and make sure all my questions are going to be answered. Or if the pharmacist has questions for me about how I'm going to take this or show me the medication, right? Pour it out in their hand and show me this is the color of these tablets or this is the size of these capsules. You know, that's even important on refill prescriptions just to make sure everything's accurate. And I think when you're interacting with a health professional who's very stressed, who's very rushed, who just doesn't have the time to talk with you, yeah, that can be pretty disconcerting that they're not spending the right amount of time with you, or maybe they're not completely answering your questions for you. So again, another way that patients are potentially going to be impacted by this situation.
Dave, in just our last minute or so, another related issue is some communities don't really even have access to a pharmacy nearby. Are you concerned about, and maybe connected to concerns about labor availability, are you worried about pharmacy deserts in some communities?
Yeah, for sure. This is something that's been going on over the past 10 or 15 years is pharmacies closing in areas, especially in rural areas or areas in, you know, inner cities where the pharmacy is a critical access point for healthcare. In some of these areas, having a pharmacist, a trained healthcare provider, a pharmacist in those areas is incredibly important for access to drugs, information, vaccination. So when we get into the situation where the only pharmacy in town is closing, either because they can't attract workers or the economic model doesn't support the business anymore, then we're in the situation where you've got vulnerable patients that are in these vulnerable areas not having access to a healthcare provider. And yeah, it can be pretty significant in terms of the population health impacts in those areas. So something that's very concerning.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dave Mott, Professor of Social and Administrative Sciences at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison. Talked to him about recent walkouts by pharmacy workers at CVS and Walgreens to draw attention to what they say is inadequate staffing and poor working conditions. Still time to share your thoughts, your experiences. You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. In some cases, people can get effective hospital care in their own homes. Kate and her guests dig into the hospital at home concept And again, if you have a personal experience with that, with yourself, a loved one, or as somebody providing that kind of service, you can share your comments and thoughts right now. Email ideas at WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 7 on the Ideas Network. Today marks a big moment for fans of, well, this. It's the anniversary of the creation of modern public broadcasting as we know it as a part of federal law. On this day in 1967, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Public Broadcasting Act into law, setting the stage for the creation of NPR on the radio, PBS on TV, and marking a big moment for local and state affiliates as well. Now, public broadcasting had been around for a long time in Wisconsin before 1967. Public TV as a network came on the air in the state in 1954. Wisconsin Public Radio goes back even further. The starting year depends on how you slice it. What we could call a radio network goes back to maybe 1947. There were some earlier simulcasts. If you want to take the history back to the first experimental broadcast, well, mark that to 1914 or 15. One early Morse code transmission was the results of a Wisconsin-Ohio State basketball game on February 17th, 1917. Couldn't find the results of that one, though. Dash, 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 dot, dash. This is Central Time.